This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Jonathan Franzen, whose new novel, called Purity, was published on September 1st. Purity is the name of the first character we meet in the novel, a young woman in her 20s who is known as Pip. She feels trapped by the $130,000 she owes in student loans, and she's living with squatters. Her mother, an eccentric loner, won't reveal much of her past to Pip, and won't disclose the identity of Pip's father. Pip soon accepts an offer to work with the charismatic founder of a rival to WikiLeaks, which publishes secret documents as well as other secrets. She hopes this job will give her access to information that might uncover who her father is. In writing about these and other characters, Franzen writes about the internet, secrets, feminism, marriage, parenthood, jealousy, divorce, and murder.
Jonathan Franzen, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from the novel, and why don't we take it from the very beginning, and by we, I mean you.
All right, page one. Oh, pussycat, I'm so glad to hear your voice, the girl's mother said on the telephone. My body is betraying me again. Sometimes I think my life is nothing but one long process of bodily betrayal. Isn't that everyone's life? The girl, Pip, said. She'd taken to calling her mother midway through her lunch break at Renewable Solutions. It brought her some relief from the feeling that she wasn't suited for her job, that she had a job that nobody could be suited for, or that she was a person unsuited for any kind of job. And then, after 20 minutes, she could honestly say that she needed to get back to work. My left eyelid is drooping, her mother explained. It's like there's a weight on it that's pulling it down like a tiny fisherman's sinker or something. Right now? Off and on, I'm wondering if it might be Bell's palsy. Whatever Bell's palsy is, I'm sure you don't have it. If you don't even know what it is, pussycat, how can you be so sure? I don't know, because he didn't have Graves' disease, hyperthyroidism, melanoma. It wasn't as if Pip felt good about making fun of her mother. But their dealings were all tainted by moral hazard, a useful phrase she'd learned in college economics. She was like a bank too big in her mother's economy to fail, an employee too indispensable to be fired for bad attitude. Some of her friends in Oakland also had problematic parents, but they still managed to speak to them daily without undue weirdnesses transpiring, because even the most problematic of them had resources that consisted of more than just their single offspring. Pip was it, as far as her own mother was concerned.
And that's Jonathan Franzen reading from the very beginning of his new novel, Purity. I think that part of the novel is pretty funny. Do you see this as, in part, a comic novel, even though you're dealing with some pretty serious issues and even though the tone is not consistently comic?
Yeah, I've always thought of myself as a comic novelist. It's a tough row to hoe because comedy means light in people's mind, and there was an ambitious part of me that kind of chafed and was secretly relieved when the comedy was overlooked. But at a certain point, it becomes wearing for people not to get the humor. I do these readings from my work, and people come up to me afterwards, and they say, wow, I had no idea this was funny until I heard people laughing. So it's a little frustrating. And yes, this book is no exception. It's the overall spirit, I think, is comic.
Secrecy is at the heart of Purity. Just about every character has a secret that they have. At the same time, one of those characters is an investigative reporter who starts an investigative journalism organization. And one of those other characters starts an internet group that's kind of like WikiLeaks, and that it's called the Sunlight Project, and their mission is to expose secrets, whether they're state secrets or more personal secrets. And I think one of the questions you're raising in the novel is, what's the difference between secrecy and privacy, and what's the difference between a secret that should be exposed and a secret that it's healthy to keep?
Certainly these are questions that I'd be happy if a reader asked, yes. I had the idea for the book. I kind of plotted it out roughly at a time when there was a great deal of anxiety about transparency versus privacy, secrecy, and also a great deal of anxiety about what was happening to the very notion of identity when so much of identity now seems to consist of what is online, what you present or what other people present about you. So in a somewhat obsessive way, I gave every main character in the book some kind of secret, yes. And, well, here's the thing. Secrets have a different kind of value for a novelist, and you don't want to find yourself in the position as a novelist of hanging the suspense in a novel on a secret that will be revealed at the end. Because for one thing, nowadays, someone could just tell you what the secret is, and then if that's what's driving the whole book, then the whole thing falls apart. But also because it seems like kind of bad faith on the author's part to withhold really important information. It seems like a kind of, well, sort of a low-class game to play with the reader. So the secrets are not from the reader. They are from other characters. And I realize that you can get a different kind of suspense going about when will this other person learn that secret or whether that other person will learn that secret. And that's what I did in this case.
In talking about secrecy and privacy, is that something you feel like you have to deal with as a novelist? I mean, you're creating secrets for your characters. But you have to deal with your own privacy, too, because you've got people like me interviewing you and wanting to know all about you. And you take, as I think most novelists do, fragments of your life and filter them through fiction to make new stories. So is it difficult ever to figure out what's the difference between secrecy and privacy?
Not so much for me. Andreas, who's the East German character in the book, has a little speech about how secrets function in the creation of identity and also in the creation of trust and intimacy. And his theory is that you need to have some things that no one else knows because that's how you're not just this transparent thing in the world. It gives you a firm sense of I'm me and I have things that only I know about me. And yet you don't want to be just totally locked up in yourself. You want to have intimate relationships. And the way those typically function is through an exchange of secrets. This is what I secretly think about party A. And, oh, I have that same thought or I have a different thought. And that's how two friends might get together, by sharing things that they wouldn't necessarily share with everyone. And so when you imagine a society of total transparency or a society of total exhibitionism, you start wondering how can there be intimacy? But to get back to your other question about, you know, the fact that I'm in the business of betraying secrets about myself, I've written a lot of confessional essays. I've written a fairly confessional memoir. There it becomes weird, but there is a wish, I think, to be in an intimate relationship with a readership. And I'm not going to tell you everything, but I'm going to tell you more than most people would tell the world, because that's how trust and intimacy are formed. I'm not going to hold back. I'm going to and the writer is in a weird position because that's not something most people do. Sometimes it begins to verge into a feeling of exhibitionism, like why am I feeling compelled to tell this compromising story about my long dead parents? You know, it's certainly a question my oldest brother asked me. Do we really need to hear any more of that? But I guess I feel like if it's done for a particular purpose, it's okay.
Yeah, so just something that you just said, that your brother said, why do you need to tell that compromising story about your parents and embed that in fiction? And you know,
nonfiction.
Worse.
Yeah, worse. Yeah, exactly.
And so, like, you've written up about how you feel deep loyalty to family. Your parents were probably dead when you wrote that part. It was seen as a betrayal by your brother, as a betrayal.
Yes.
But do you still feel like that somehow, even though they're dead, you can still betray them by revealing personal stories or revealing things that they would have preferred to be kept secret? Like, how do you come to terms with that? Like, what the statute of limitations is on respecting the privacy and the values of someone who you're very close to when they're actually no longer alive?
I think you can't hurt them when they're dead, basically. My parents were good parents, and I don't really have anything bad to say about them, really. And I think if you read the nonfiction I've written about them, they tend to be very loving portraits. And that's key. It's not like I'm coming forward to blacken the name of people who can no longer defend themselves. I am working through my own memory of them, trying to convey what was really, really specific, interesting, great about them. And sometimes that does mean showing them at really tough moments.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Franzen. His new novel is called Purity. I want to quote something that you told to Laura Miller in an interview, and you said, "It gets harder to write novels, not easier, as time goes by, and that has to do with using up the easy stuff, the stuff that is fairly close to the surface, and then going back for the mid-level stuff, and then suddenly all you're left with is this very deep stuff, and there is good reason why you haven't written about it before, because you don't know how, or you really don't want to talk about it." So are you implying that there are things in Purity, in your new novel, that is that really deep-level stuff that you've avoided for one reason or another in the past because it was too difficult or you didn't know how to say it?
That would appear to be the implication, yes, Carrie.
So can you talk about what that was and how you found a fictional approach for talking about it? Would that be betraying?
Well, yes. I mean, the question sort of answers itself. If there are things that I can only talk about in symbolic form in a made-up story, then it would kind of defeat the purpose of writing the novel if I could just sort of give you a list of what those things were and how I worked with them. What might be an example? There are a lot of mothers in the book. And some, I think, rather bad mothers and some kind of some good, some bad mothers and maybe one ultimately pretty good mother. And I feel as if I needed a whole range to encompass the complexity of my feelings about my own mom. She was a really, really big personality. And people who say, "Oh, well, you put her as into the corrections as Enid," it's like, no, I put a cartoon version of one layer of her into that book. There was so much more to her, and there was so much more to the difficulty of my having that person as a mother, and probably for her the difficulty of having me as that youngest son. We spent a lot of time alone together, a whole lot. It was as if I was an only child. My brothers were so much older. My father was often on the road. So I had thousands of evenings alone with my mom. But there's the romantic nature of a certain kind of bond between mother and son, and even the not the literal sexual dimensions of it, but the kind of symbolic sexual dimensions of it. That's really hot stuff and really, really hard to talk about. And it's not even clear that I could talk about it because I'm not even sure what I would say. It's not like my mother abused me. It's not like she did anything wrong. Ultimately, she was a great mom. Look, you know, I've had a happy life. I've had a productive life. How bad could she have been? But there were these currents, and I had the sense that those currents really actually matter and are still operative in the way I relate to the world and to other people. And certainly nothing scandalous from my own youth, but just the combination of a very involved mom who had some frustrations with her husband and an extraordinarily sensitive kid meant that I was in touch with those currents, even though they were all kind of in my head.
Let's get to the subject of feminism. And you have been criticized by some people through like social media and through reviews for not being sympathetic to feminists or, you know, to some women. And I'm not endorsing that view. I'm just referring to that. And so in this novel, you kind of address feminism in some ways, like, you know, Pip's mother. I think it's fair to say she sees herself as a feminist, but
she's kind of a bad feminist, actually.
Well, in fact, one of the characters says just that. One of the characters describes her as the kind of feminist who gives feminism a bad name. Of course, that's very toward the end of the book. not right. Everybody will get to that sentence. So I'm thinking that's a kind of dangerous character for you, for people who don't take that point of view, that you're intentionally creating somebody who is not a very good example of feminism, although she sees herself as a feminist.
Well, yeah, there's nothing I can do about people who don't want to finish a book. As far as I can tell, most things on social media require reading no more than a sentence of anything I've written. and often not actually reading it except as it's been retweeted by somebody else. That's what I mean about a discouragement about the level of discourse. The rewards online are so much to the extreme position, to the divisive position, to the out-of-context quote that seems scandalous because you've left the context out. That's, you know, financially rewarding, and it's rewarding in terms of having followers. And it's all very discouraging, and it's like I don't even – it just makes me tired to even want to try to rebut things that are so stupid. But in terms of the portrayal of this feminist, I mean there are several. There are three avowed feminists in the book, not just Pip's mother. There is Tom, the investigative publisher.
And you describe him as a strange hybrid feminist, behaviorally beyond reproach, but conceptually hostile.
That's right. He's somebody who came up in the 70s and was whole hog bought into the radical critique of 70s feminism of the patriarchy. And he felt, I'm guilty. I belong to the patriarchy. Through no fault of my own, I've been born a man, and men have done terrible things to women. They continue to. And having had, you know, he had a mother who was sick most of her life, and he was kind of morbidly attentive to the sorrows and pains of women. He kind of went whole hog for that critique and came out the other side of it feeling like this is a dead end for a man. All you can do is try to behave well. You can't make yourself not a man. And in part, the book tells the story of his trying to make himself not a man and barely escaping with his life, feeling as if he's barely escaped with his life. And then there's the third character, Lila, who thinks of herself very much as a feminist and has been a working woman, hardworking, ambitious woman, successful woman with a career all her life, but feels like a betrayal of the sisterhood because she, you know, her primary relationships are with men. It's not a simple caricature of any kind of feminist. There is a spectrum here. So that's one point. The other point, I think, is help me out here.
Okay.
We're trailing off.
Let's move to an example. Like you said, Tom almost like tries to not be a man, and that doesn't work. In Tom's marriage to the transgressive artist who sees herself as, you know, a feminist, she says to him at one point, and this is probably the paragraph that's gotten the most attention from your book, you know, for whatever reason, but I want to ask you about it. She says to him that he needs to stop peeing standing up because it creates too much splash on the seat of the bowl, on the bowl itself, on the floor around it, and she can't expect him to clean up every time he goes. So she's going to ask him to sit down, and she basically says, if I have to sit down, then you should have to sit down too. And honestly, I really didn't know how to interpret that because I know, I'm pretty sure that Freud used to say that women had penis envy and that they wanted to be able to stand up. And like outside of situations where there's like a really filthy bathroom, I don't think that's really an issue for women, that women envy men that. And so I'm kind of curious hearing how that kind of made it in and what you're going for there.
Well, that has to be taken in the context of his wife's whole personality. She is an extreme person. She has sort of a borderline personality, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has to do with this crazy idealism of youth where the wish is to be identical, to merge, to have nothing, no differences between them. And for her, this is a difference. So yes, she talks the talk of feminism, but what's going on there is she's desperately afraid of being abandoned. And she has this kind of crackpot youthful notion, which many young people do, that, you know, if we can totally merge our souls and be alike in everything, then I will never be abandoned. So I got an interesting email this morning from a friend in Holland who says that all Dutch mothers teach their little boys to sit down. And I was like, really? That's interesting. Tells you something about Holland. And that's merely to take one dimension of that particular scene. There is Tom's response to it. And to me, the whole description of that doomed marriage is a comedy. And it is... not everyone has been in a relationship with a difficult person that they felt trapped by, but many people have, and the friends I have who have get that that's a comic chapter. It's a very dark comedy of what happens when two people get together young and have this notion of total sharing. No secrets, no differences. And you know, what you do in a comic novel is you exaggerate. You put salmon in the character's pants, or you have this scene where one of the people in the relationship is being really, really irrational and difficult and asking for something that nobody should ask the partner for, because it's funny and because it's memorable and because it tears up the surface and gets at deeper things. And yeah, maybe the Freud stuff is in there and the envy, but I don't actually think that's what is going on for Annabelle. Certainly that not in my mind. I wasn't thinking of Freud in that. I was thinking she has taken a particular self-pitying version of feminism and is using it kind of to abuse her boyfriend.
I know that you were very close to David Foster Wallace, and I'm wondering if you've seen the new movie based on interviews he did with David Lipsky, who was a reporter for Rolling Stone. And apparently the movie's been very controversial among people who were close to him and to his estate, to his editor, because he was such a private person, and they feel like he gave his permission to record these interviews but not to have a movie made about him. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind talking about it, if you've seen the movie, what your thoughts about it are, and if you haven't seen the movie, is it because you felt like you shouldn't see the movie?
No, I had no interest in seeing a movie. Why would I want to see some actor playing Dave? Also, I'm very close to Karen, Dave's widow, and I know how hard she and the estate tried to stop the movie. And also I had read the pieces by Tom LeClaire and Glenn Kinney online, and I had a feeling I would probably feel the same thing they did. Angry in the case of LeClaire, because the spirit of the movie is just so radically non-consonant with the spirit of Dave's work. And also because Glenn Kenny's piece was so filled with sadness, just to see this travesty, basically, of somebody he knew and liked and knew this was not a movie about him. It was a movie about David Lipsky.
You know, David Foster Wallace, I don't really know the circumstances and behind his death, but I know he did suffer with, you know, periods of very severe depression and had tried to take his life much earlier, like I think when he was a teenager. But being so close to him and watching how sadness beyond sadness about how, you know, profound a depression can make you choose death. I'm sure you've battled your own depressions and your own demons the way most writers and so many other people have. Did you find it frightening that someone who you knew so well could be suffering to such an extreme?
I think I got kind of lifetime immunity regarding extreme mental suffering because of the 2 years my father spent in hospital and nursing home with dementia and depression. So I had seen somebody suffering horribly for a long time. And it's not immunity. It's my compassion is aroused, but it doesn't frighten me. And David was not the only friend of mine who has been in a mental hospital. I actually never saw Dave in a mental hospital. I only saw him at home after his release, after his several releases, if you count the 80s. So I understand you get a very if you are around people who are suffering from mental illness, you realize that it's an illness. And you also have a sense of how different it is from your own manageable depression, or at least in my case, that it becomes physically excruciating and just, you know, like the most terrible pain you can suffer, many people report. And you really see that, and it's just like being in the hospital with somebody who's in terrible physical pain. Mm-hmm. And it can be done, and it's very frustrating not to be able to do anything about it, or to be able to do like 1% of what you wish you could do. Because, you know, David would thank me repeatedly and assure me that I was doing something by being with him, but it was not very much what I could do. And it was like the window was in his eyes almost was 99% shut. And, you know, he was such a big personality. 1% was still a lot, but that's what I was getting. The thank yous came from the 1% that was getting through. And I could tell that the so much was not available.
There's an author photo in the back of your new book, Purity. And in it, you're on the beach. I assume it's at the beach in Santa Cruz because that's where you live.
No, actually, it's the beach in Egypt.
Oh, really?
Yes, I was in Egypt for 3 weeks reporting on the killing of migratory birds there. And we'd been in the Sahara and were very dusty and very parched and hot. And we finally made it back to the Mediterranean. And my thought was, take off your boots and get in the water. So that's where that picture's from.
Why did you choose that as your author photo?
Because I'm just absolutely happy looking.
I thought you were too.
Because like happy as only somebody who's been in the Sahara for 4 days and as suddenly has, you know, cool Mediterranean water around their feet can be happy. It was just such an incredible relief.
Happy looking is not the first description that comes to mind when people think of you, right?
It's so weird.
Right.
It's so weird. I am a glutton for fun. It becomes a problem. Like I actually have a hard time buckling down and doing reading that I should be doing because I, you know, there's such fun TV on. It's fun to play Hearts on a computer. It's so fun to play tennis. It's fun to birdwatch. It's fun to eat good food in Santa Cruz. It's like, where does this idea come that I'm this sour guy? It's like crazy. But maybe I try too hard to keep it under wraps because I already feel sort of guilty for how well things have gone for me, and I have to be photographed with a frown to make clear that I'm not enjoying the experience, but really I am enjoying the experience.
Jonathan Franzen's new novel is called Purity. You can hear a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Our understanding of autism has changed over the decades, and that's the subject of a new book by our next guest, science writer Steve Silberman. He writes about how autism was first diagnosed in Vienna, research that was ended after the Nazis invaded Austria. In his book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, Silberman explains the shifts in medical and social attitudes towards autism. He reports on how people who are cognitively atypical are starting their own movement to demand accommodations to some of those differences. And Silberman also examines what he considers some of the myths surrounding autism, including the one claiming that vaccines have created an autism epidemic. Silverman's articles have been published in Wired, The New Yorker, Nature, and Salon. He spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week.
Steve Silberman, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about the history of how autism was diagnosed and how our understanding of it has changed, would you just describe some of the constellation of symptoms on the autism spectrum?
Sure. People with autism often have trouble making sense of social signals in real time. And so that's things like parsing facial expressions, interpreting body language, interpreting tone of voice. So they may come across as disconnected from the people around them. For instance, if you're talking to an autistic person, they may be looking off to the side or something. But it's important to remember that at the same time that they're doing that, they may be listening very intensely. And in fact, the words that you're saying may be going deep inside them and having a big effect, but they may look like they're not paying attention to you. So they're sort of generally having difficulty making sense of the social signals that non-autistic people use to keep each other comfortable and to sort of, you know, radiate liking or disliking. So some autistic people might have trouble making sense of irony or sarcasm, although autistic people are also often capable of extremely dry wit. So it's not like they're humorless or something. They may also do things repetitively. There is a very typical autistic behavior called stimming or self-stimulation, which is things like flapping of the hands or fidgeting with a favorite object or whatever. And autistic people do that to regulate their own energy and their own anxiety. And they find it very soothing, actually, to do it. So even though in the past, psychiatrists might punish them for doing something like stimming, it's actually a relatively harmless thing, as fidgeting is considered relatively harmless for non-autistic people.
Most of us are familiar with the term Asperger's syndrome, although that term is officially not used anymore. But the term which was used to describe people on the so-called high-functioning end of autism, especially people who had a special gift or skill, that was named after Hans Asperger, an Austrian child psychologist who did a lot of research in the 1930s. And that research was ended by the Nazis in World War II. His research was overlooked until the 1970s, but you've done quite a job of bringing new attention to it in your book. What was he finding in his research with his patients in the 1930s before autism had a name? Because he gives it the name.
What Asperger discovered was not what he's usually given credit for, which is this condition called Asperger syndrome. What Asperger and his colleagues at the University of Vienna in the 1930s really discovered is what we now call the autism spectrum. And they called it the autistic continuum. And what that is they discovered that autism was a lifelong condition lasting from birth to death that embraced a very wide variety of clinical presentations. So Asperger saw children who, for instance, could not speak and would probably never be able to live independently without constant care and might end up in institutions in Viennese society at the time. He also discovered chatty people who became professors of astronomy and who would talk at length about sort of their special passions for numbers or chemistry or et cetera. So what he discovered was not just this, you know, so-called high-functioning end of the spectrum. He discovered the entire spectrum. And he was working with a very dedicated group of clinicians in a situation that was very unusual. It was like a combination clinic and school. And one of the things that I found for my book, which is an amazing stroke of luck, was I found the daily schedule in use in Asperger's clinic.
In 1938, the Nazis invaded Austria, and that changes everything at Asperger's clinic. Many of the people he works with flee. Some of them commit suicide. And he is still trying to do his work. How did the Nazi regime affect his ability to work with the autistic children?
The children in Asperger's clinic immediately became targets of the Nazi eugenic programs. And in fact, one of Asperger's former colleagues was actually the leader of a secret extermination program against disabled children that became the dry run for the Holocaust. So the Nazis actually developed methods of mass killing by practicing on disabled children and children with hereditary conditions like autism, even though it didn't have a name yet, epilepsy, schizophrenia. And so immediately Asperger had to figure out ways of protecting the children in his clinic. So one of the ways that he did that was to present to the Nazis in the very first public talk on autism in history his quote-unquote most promising cases. And that is where the idea of so-called high-functioning versus low-functioning autistic people comes from, really. It comes from Asperger's attempt to save the lives of the children in his clinic.
It's just really amazing that the discovery of autism, the diagnosis of autism, coincides with the Nazi eugenics program of wanting to kill people who weren't either racially pure or mentally pure in their eyes. And so just as, you know, Hans Asperger is discovering all these beautiful things in his autistic children, they become targets. It's so sad. It's so tragic.
It is so tragic. And I mean, I have to confess that I would literally weep while I was writing that chapter. And I came across some lines that have just stayed in my head forever. Like, in the very first public talk on autism ever given in history, which was in 1938, Hans Asperger told an audience of Nazis, including his supervisor, who was a huge fan of Hitler, quote, "Not everything that steps out of line or is unusual is inferior." And, you know, in the Nazi context, that was an incredibly dangerous thing to say. And in fact, the Gestapo came to his clinic three times to arrest Asperger and to ship the children in his clinic off to concentration camps or kill them at a so-called children's killing ward. But that guy had affection for Asperger. He thought he was very good at what he did. So he saved Asperger's life. And so that's how Asperger survived the war.
My guest is science journalist Steve Silberman, author of a new book about autism called Neurotribes: The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. It tells the history of how autism was first diagnosed and how the diagnostic criteria shaped our perceptions of autism. The condition was given its name in the 1930s by Dr. Hans Asperger, whose research in Vienna was ended after the Nazi invasion. One of his associates who fled Vienna worked with Dr. Leo Kanner at Johns Hopkins University. Kanner was often credited as being the first person to diagnose autism by people who were unaware of Asperger's earlier work. Dr. Kanner had a much narrower definition of autism than Dr. Asperger did. Two women basically rediscovered Hans Asperger's research, and they wanted to widen the definition of autism. They thought it was too narrow. How did they end up discovering Asperger's research, and what were the results of that discovery?
In the 1970s, a cognitive psychologist in London named Lorna Wing, who had an autistic daughter and was very aware of the challenges that were faced by families with autistic children in search of services, she and a research assistant did a survey in a London suburb called Camberwell to look for autistic children in the community. And what they found was that there were many, many more of them than Connor's narrow model of autism would have predicted. So they said, you know, what's going on? I wonder why Connor drew his model so narrowly. And they figured out what was going on when Lorna stumbled across a reference to Asperger's paper, which had still not been translated into English because Connor had never mentioned it. And Lorna's husband, John, translated it for her. And she immediately saw that what Asperger had seen in Vienna was what she was seeing in London in the 1970s. And so Lorna quietly worked with the people who were designing the next edition of the DSM to broaden the scope of the diagnosis. And so, in a sense, she swapped out Connor's criteria for Asperger's criteria. And almost immediately, as not only she predicted, but she hoped, the number of diagnoses started soaring, because what she wanted was for families to have access to the services that a diagnosis would produce. So that was basically how the so-called autism epidemic began, when Connor's criteria were swapped out of the DSM for Asperger's criteria.
So when you say epidemic, you're putting quotation marks around it because you don't think that there was suddenly an epidemic. It's rather that the definition was broadened, therefore more people were diagnosed with having autism.
Exactly.
So we've been talking about how at some point people perceive that there's an autism epidemic. Part of that is a result of having the definition of autism broadened, so suddenly more people were being diagnosed as autistic. Were there other things happening that made people think that there was this new autism epidemic and that we need to find out what was causing it?
Absolutely. There was an incredible convergence of events towards the end of the 1980s that produced a vast increase in autism awareness. One of them is that in 1988, most people in the world who had never seen an autistic adult saw one for the first time. And that person was Dustin Hoffman's character of Raymond Babbitt in the Academy Award-winning film Rain Man. It was an incredible success. And for parents of autistic children, it meant the end of having to explain to their neighbors, no, our child is not artistic, they're autistic. Virtually no one outside of the community of families and clinicians had heard of autism before Rain Man. And Rain Man introduced this incredibly beguiling, eccentric, instantly recognizable character. Everybody loved Raymond Babbitt. And I had mothers tell me that when they were out in public with their kids, if their kids would, you know, start having a difficult moment, that they would often get sour looks from other parents. But literally within days of Rain Man's release, other parents would inquire, oh, is your child autistic like Rain Man? So Rain Man created this wave of cultural awareness of autism more than any of the autism organizations had been able to accomplish in decades before that.
So what were the consequences of the perception that there was an autism epidemic and that suddenly more people had the characteristics of autism as opposed to suddenly more people were being diagnosed with what they already had?
Well, right at the moment that the true dimensions of what you might call the autistic community were becoming apparent because the diagnostic criteria had finally been broadened enough to allow these people to become diagnosed, right at that moment, a guy in England named Andrew Wakefield, who was a gastroenterologist, released an instantly controversial paper blaming a certain form of autism that he claimed was novel on the MMR vaccine. And as you might imagine, both the British tabloid press and the American press went wild, a child made autistic by jab, et cetera. And so there was a kind of worldwide panic about vaccines. Now, here's the thing. I completely understand why parents would believe that their child had been rendered autistic by a vaccine for several reasons. One is that autism often doesn't become obvious to both clinicians and parents and teachers and everybody until a child is two or three, which is exactly the age when many children are receiving their vaccinations. Also, the internet was a new thing at the time, and so the word that there was a theory that vaccines cause autism was spreading rapidly through the same communities in which autism parents were finally able to talk to each other online. So, it's while people tend to stereotype what are now called anti-vaxxers as these kind of, you know, low information people, et cetera. In fact, the people who believed that were often highly informed and read, you know, read papers obsessively. But the problem is that nobody had explained to them what had happened with the diagnosis. And Wakefield's paper, which has since been retracted by The Lancet and called a deliberate fraud by the editors of the British Medical Journal, you know, he, instead of saying, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I was wrong, he ended up portraying himself as a martyr to this conspiracy between big pharma, the media, and corrupt public health officials.
When in fact, according to what you report, Wakefield actually had a financial stake in lawyers who were planning to sue the pharmaceutical companies that produced vaccines, vaccines that would have been discredited had his paper been upheld.
That's true. And I have to say, people think that the notion that Big Pharma could engage in a conspiracy on a global scale to cover up, you know, a wave of vaccine injury, is that plausible? Absolutely. Look at what the pharmaceutical industry did with Vioxx, where, you know, hundreds or even thousands of people died before this drug was taken off the market. So it was a very believable story. The only problem was it wasn't true.
Steve Silverman is the author of the new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.